It's the first ever securities fraud case against a U.S. state.
And it's over.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Thursday, August 19th. Congratulations, New Jersey. You've made history, but there may be more to come.
Also on the podcast today, oil is discovered off Mozambique, a mixed blessing. And would you wear a man girdle? Okay, what if it were called a compression undershirt?
Mm.
But first, the government's financial regulator, the Securities and Exchange Commission, says it has settled a case against New Jersey. You heard that right. It's not a case against a bank or a mutual fund. It is the first time a state has been charged with securities fraud. We're joined live by Marketplace's Gregory Warner in Philadelphia. Hi, Gregory.
Good morning.
How does a state commit securities fraud?
Well, it starts with the state's two largest pension funds, the teacher's pension and the public employee's pension. And during the period we're talking about, which is 2001 to 2006, New Jersey paid only a third of the contribution that state law required. But they were always promising to fully fund those plans in the future. And that promise is really where this trouble starts, because the SEC says state officials had abandoned that promise. Meanwhile, New Jersey was asking investors to buy its state bonds, raising over $26 billion. And you combine those two things, that's the fraud. The SEC says the state sold bonds without telling investors that they had this pension debt they weren't planning to settle up.
Uh-huh. And what are the consequences for the state?
Well, New Jersey has settled the case, as you said. So state officials are saying no harm here. Bond investors have been paid. The state's bond rating hasn't gone down. But the SEC is conducting investigations into other states. Lots of states have taken New Jersey's exact strategy, avoid financial disaster by raising money with municipal bonds. And demand for these municipal bonds is very, very high these days because they're seen as safe.
Mm-hmm. So this does not end with New Jersey. The SEC has got other states in its sights?
Well, Bill, as a sign of the SEC's seriousness on this, as of January, they have a new unit, the Municipal Securities and Public Pension Unit. And that's not just a title. You got a unit, you got desks, you have staff. You need something to do. You need cases to solve, right?
Marketplace's Gregory Warner. Thanks, Gregory.
Thank you, Bill.
This morning, we learned the number of people filing new jobless benefit claims rose last week by 12,000 up to 500,000. Let's say hello to economist Diane Swonk of Mesirow Financial, who joins us every Thursday from Chicago. Hi, Diane.
Good morning.
As I said, new unemployment claims jumped last week to 500,000. I thought they were supposed to fall.
Well, they are supposed to be falling, but we do have some distortions in there. The auto industry had later closings than usual, which is buoying claims, along with the end of census hires. But more importantly, veterans are beginning to return from Iraq, and that's starting to buoy the numbers because they're coming back to a more hostile labor market than when they left.
So returning veterans is, I'll grant you, an unusual factor, but Diane, is that supposed to make us feel better?
Well, you know, we like the veterans to come home. The problem is we'd like to see an employment market that is strong enough to absorb them and give them jobs when they come home. And this is something that by this stage of the game should have been, you know, a blip on the radar screen, not such an extraordinary surge in unemployment claims.
Mm-hmm. Diane Swonk of Mesirow Financial, thanks.
Thank you.
Chipmaker Intel says it'll buy the antivirus software maker McAfee in a cash transaction worth nearly $8 billion. Now, McAfee would become a wholly owned subsidiary of Intel's software group. Chris Nuttall is technology correspondent with the Financial Times. He joins us live right now from London. Good day to you, sir.
Good day.
I'm curious, Chris, as to what Intel thinks an antivirus software can bring to Intel, to its chip-making company, a hardware company.
Yeah, I was scratching my head to begin with on this, but the way Intel sees it is that security is a third pillar of the computing experience, they say. The other two pillars up to now have been internet connectivity and energy efficiency. And they see the fact that billions of devices are going to come online over the next few years, embedded devices like your fridge or your TV, mobile phones, obviously, and they're all going to need security. So Intel wants to tie security software closer to its chips and have an advantage over its competitors in the market. And McAfee, it's its biggest ever acquisition. The previous biggest acquisition was a networking chip company more than 10 years ago for $2.2 billion. So it's pushing the boat out here to the tune of nearly $8 billion. But it thinks it's a really central strategy for the company as a whole.
As you mentioned, Chris, it's been a while since Intel has really ventured out like this. What does it say about the health of the computer market?
Well, this will help them not just in computers. They do have quite a good security strategy in the enterprise for business computers, something called vPro, and active administration is called, and they can turn your computer off and they can search it remotely for viruses. But they see a huge market that they want to make inroads in smartphones. They think security is going to be a big issue there in the future, also in TVs and all kinds of other devices. So they see huge markets there, as well as the computer market, which is growing as well. And this will help in all of those areas.
Just a few seconds left, Chris. Could there be any kinks in this deal with the past antitrust accusations lobbed at Intel?
They just reached a deal with the Federal Trade Commission this month over alleged market dominance and how they were abusing that. Paul Otellini, chief executive, said today that they weren't looking at bundling McAfee's software with Intel hardware, and they intended to continue to work with other security vendors. So I don't think he sees a problem there.
All right, Chris Nuttall from the Financial Times in London. Chris, thanks.
Thank you.
We got word from the company that operates retailer Sears that it lost about $40 million in its latest quarter. That is a smaller loss than this time last year, but it reaffirms Sears is in need of some fresh, new ideas, as reporter Jay Field explains.
The centerpiece of the Sears reinvention plan is an online service called My Gopher. At first glance, it's pretty standard stuff. Users can browse the millions of products carried by Sears and subsidiaries like Kmart. Things get a little more interesting when customers actually decide to buy something. Here's sales manager Mike Simpson pitching My Gopher to shoppers at a Kmart in Chicago.
You pick everything you want, you pay for it online, and I'll have it ready within 2 hours for you at customer service.
The goal is to appeal to customers who are eager to shop on the web but don't want to wait for stuff to come in the mail. Right now, My Gopher lets shoppers in Chicago, Boston, New York, and Washington, D.C. buy online and pick up their items at the closest Sears or Kmart. They can also have their order delivered, and if they want something else, say some groceries, and can't find them on the site, My Gopher will send sales reps like Mike Simpson to the nearest supermarket to fill the order. Shopper Lawrence Tribble, standing next to Simpson, likes that idea.
Yeah, I sure don't like the shop.
See?
Yeah. Right about
there. So why put you in pain when I can do it for you? I'd be happy to do it for you. I love the shop. I know it sounds kind of weird, but I love the shop.
Executives at Sears have to hope that Simpson's enthusiasm is contagious. The retailer has a lot riding on My Gopher. 3 years ago, the company's stock traded at nearly $200 a share. But since then, Sears has seen its in-store sales and overall profitability steadily decline. Lauren Friedman, who runs the e-tailing group in Chicago, applauds the My Gopher strategy, but says it may not be enough to solve the company's bigger problems.
Perception-wise, the part of the challenge for Sears is it's not the first place people think when they want to go shopping, and particularly for the younger audience.
Sears says that perception is already changing, and the company is pushing ahead with an expansion of My Gopher after getting positive customer feedback. By November, the service will be operating in more than 600 stores. In Chicago, I'm Jay Field for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Thursday, August 19th. I'm Bill Radke. For the latest look at the markets, always go to the numbers at marketplace.org. Here's a headline you don't see every day. State budget surplus grows. The governor of Virginia is expected to announce this morning his state ended its fiscal year with an extra $400 million. That's almost twice the earlier estimate. So what's Virginia got going that most other states don't? Marketplace's John Dimsdale has that.
Virginia is one of about 10 states that ended the budget year in the black. Scott Patterson with the National Association of State Budget Officers says many states are beginning to see better than expected tax collections.
The problem is we're still looking at state budgets that are in a lot of pain because they're not back to where they were pre-recession.
Virginia got some help from lots of federal government spending in the state, especially for the military. It also aggressively cut spending for schools, health care and transportation, and deferred payments to the state employee pension plan. Patterson says it's going to take a while for most states to recover.
Because of cuts and other things they've had to do, or avoidance of dealing with certain things like pensions, they're now going to have to deal with those as times get better.
Virginia's governor will use the windfall to restore some of the cuts in education and roads, but some state lawmakers want to keep the money in case things get rough again. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Today, the government will tell us which jobs had the highest fatality rates last year. Judging from past years, one of the most dangerous professions will again be commercial fishing. There may be ways to protect people in the fishing industry, but Marketplace's Janet Babin reports what's good for safety might be bad for business.
One thing that makes this line of work so dicey is the frenzy surrounding the catch. In many fisheries, the minute the season opens, boats race to reel in as many fish as they can. Photographer Karen Ducey crabbed under this system in Alaska's Bering Sea.
You would work around the clock, and you would work like 100 miles an hour. I think we would get about 4 hours of sleep at night. That's where the danger element would come in, because you're exhausted.
Alaska fisheries have since switched to what's called a catch share quota system. Kate Bonson with the Environmental Defense Fund wants all U.S. fisheries to use this type of quota system.
Catch shares provide fishermen with a secure access to a certain amount of fish, and it allows them to be a lot more flexible about when they go fish.
Bonson says catch shares reduce fatalities and stabilize fish stocks. Some fishermen, though, complain the system nibbles away at their profits and curbs the adventure associated with the profession. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
And you can see some of photographer Karen Ducey's astonishing crabbing photos at marketplace.org. Oyster harvesting is still banned in most of the waters off Louisiana, thanks to the BP oil leak. And what's bad news in Louisiana might be good news in Maryland. Reporter Kathy Ducham tells us about the rise of aquaculture in Chesapeake Bay.
Many wannabe oyster farmers already have a relationship with the mollusk. Take this guy, who calls himself Johnny Oysterseed.
Yep, this is the oyster nursery. So this is one way that we get oysters started in an aquaculture sense.
Johnny Oysterseed, a.k.a. John Farrington, grows baby oysters in this supersized jacuzzi next to a creek that feeds Chesapeake Bay. His customers are conservation types who use the bivalves to filter pollution out of the water. Soon, Farrington hopes to grow oysters for food and sell them to restaurants and packing houses.
If we, develop an industry around aquaculture, we'd have millions of bushels of harvest. I think the potential is really that big.
The state of Maryland is getting ready to lease 600,000 acres of Chesapeake Bay bottom to people like Farrington. It's part of a plan to rebuild an oyster population that is 1% what it was 100 years ago. The strategy: encourage aquaculture and discourage the harvest of wild oysters. But oyster farming is not for the faint of heart.
It's hard work, and the drudgery and the heat and the sun. And in the winter, it's the cold and the ice and the westerly winds.
Kevin McLaren runs the Chop Tank Oyster Company. He grows 8 million oysters in cages that float in the mild brine of the Chesapeake Bay. McLaren says selling oysters is the toughest part of the business.
We go up into Philadelphia, up into D.C. We do shucking events. You know, anything that's related to chefs and restaurants.
McLaren says he's not afraid of new competition. And Johnny Oysterseed is not afraid of hard work. He says he'll camp on the doorstep of state offices on September 7th to be the first in line to apply for an oyster lease. In St. Leonard, Maryland, I'm Kathy Ducham from Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Thursday, August 19th. I'm Steve Chiatakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at our website, marketplace.org. We're going to get a take now on the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics around the world and how it affects us right here in the United States. American oil company Anadarko has discovered oil off the coast of the African country Mozambique. It's the first time oil's been discovered near this part of East Africa, but it's unclear whether getting oil out of the sea floor will make economic sense there. From Johannesburg, Gretchen Wilson reports.
The Texas-based company says this initial find proves the presence of oil in the region. Mozambique is one of the poorest countries in the world, and the government sure could use some additional money from an oil find, money that could go to clinics, schools, and computers. But many in Africa worry that the discovery of oil isn't always a blessing, but a curse. Thomas Seliman is with the Center for Public Integrity in Maputo, the capital of Mozambique. He's worried about the possible environmental damage from oil drilling and about how much money the oil companies will give back.
The discussion now is what can be done to ensure that these multinationals are really contributing to the national economy.
That's not necessarily happening in some African nations, including Sudan and Nigeria, where oil's discovery has also ignited armed conflict. Mozambique's oil management will be watched closely by Washington. The U.S. government estimates that by 2015, a full quarter of U.S. oil imports will come from Africa. In Johannesburg, I'm Gretchen Wilson for Marketplace.
The state of Arizona has been ground zero lately in the illegal immigration debate in this country. In Europe, France is where immigration is heated these days. The government there is expelling gypsies or Roma travelers, rounded up as part of a summer clampdown on illegal camps. From Paris, the BBC's Christian Fraser reports.
The French government says it intends to clear 300 illegal camps in the next 3 months, and the first of the return flights will leave for Romania today. The Roma are a transient population. Many of them are travellers from Romania and Bulgaria. They come to France looking for jobs, but the government isn't willing to provide any assistance, so most of them end up living in squatter camps around the country. And despite being EU citizens, they are required under French law to have a valid work permit to remain. Dana lives in one of the camps in Lyon, but didn't want to give her last name.
My rights are not respected by the state. It is racist that they ask for a French identity card when we look for work. But when you are from the European Union, they don't ask for a French ID card.
Immigration is a hot political issue in France too. One critical member of the ruling party compared the tactics to those used by Nazi Germany. Critics say most of those returned will most likely come back to France within several months. In Paris, I'm the BBC's Christian Fraser. Marketplace.
And finally, you can call them men's shapewear, call them compression undershirts. They're basically man girdles, and the Washington Post says they are all the rage.
Now, these stretchy undershirts fit like a wetsuit, which helps with the love handles and beer bellies and other jiggly parts.
Yes. Now, the Post article points out this trend isn't really new. Men have been buying garments to make them look tough since the days of armor.
Very true.
Very true. In Los Angeles, I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.